Usually in my temple we don't use bells because we believe in no bell silence. Ho ho ho. And many people on the retreats, because we don't have any bells, you know, they get such deep meditation, know what they win, what prize they win? Nobel Peace Prize. So welcome to this evening's talk and meditation, and what else? Questions and answers. So if you are sitting comfortably, then I will begin. So we're going to do some meditation first of all. That's okay with anybody? If you don't like to, now's the time to get out while the going is good. So very simple meditation, sitting down, and I'll give the guidance for the first 20 minutes or 15 minutes or so, and then we'll be quiet for a few minutes, and then I'll wrap up. Only half an hour meditation. And if you have other ways you've meditated before, most welcome to actually do it your way. So if you want to try this method, fine. If you want to do another method, fine. So we are not... That's your job. You mean I have to do anything? Can you ring the bell? Sorry? Yeah, go on. Yeah, that's you're the bell number. Whatever. Whenever I talk too much. Okay, here we go. So, if you'd like to, first of all, close your eyes. And with the eyes closed, bring some awareness onto your posture. How are you sitting right now? Are you comfortable? Or can you make yourself more comfortable by moving this, adjusting that? So you just roughly get into a good position, and now we refine our posture by doing some body awareness with some compassion practice. So to start with, can you be aware of the feelings, the sensations, aches, stress, warmth, whatever it is, in your legs, from the toes up to the thighs? How do your legs feel? Do they need to be adjusted? And don't just assume that the legs are in a good position. Experiment, try, move them, pull the foot further forward or tuck it more in, until you can find the best position for your legs. And it won't be the same for every meditation session. The body does change, so we have to be aware to adapt to the changing positions, the changing states of our body. So by being aware of the feelings, sensations in the legs, moving them this way, moving them that way, you eventually come to the best position. It's called kindness, compassion, to your own body. Caring for it, looking after it, so it's comfortable, so you won't need to move it later. And then you move up to your bottom. That bottom often is the cause for much fidgeting during meditation, because it's not comfortable. You're not careful enough and kind enough to adjust your bottom to be as comfortable as you can on the chair, on the cushion, wherever it is. So adjust the bottom. And every time you adjust, you'll get what we call feedback from your mindfulness. You can remember what it felt like before. Now you know what it feels like now. Is it got better or has it got worse? That way, fidgeting eventually stops when you find the best position. And then you move up to your back. How's your back now? Now I like the beginning of meditation like this, to stretch my back. All animals, including humans, like to stretch. And when they stretch, I feel so nice. You get endorphins going through your bloodstream. Nature's painkillers, very good for health. And then I relax my back. And so I can let it go into the most comfortable position. Sometimes if you're sitting on a chair, you can lean back. Sometimes you can have a straight back. It's not always the same every meditation. You are aware of the comfort level in your back, and you find the optimum position for your back. That is compassion. It's not assuming what's right. It's being aware and being kind to find out what is right for you. And then where you put your hands, so many different positions you can put your hands. If I'm meditating, holding a microphone in one hand, then I have a posture for doing guided meditations. But I find what's the best posture. Move my hand this way, move my hand that way, until I find the best position. This is compassion, kindness, looking after your own body. But it is also developing the quality of awareness, mindfulness, focused on your own body, out of care for it, and learning how to get the body in the best position. Many people say have back problems because they're totally unaware of their posture when they're working at their desk, typing on their computer, or even just sleeping. Once you develop the awareness of how your body feels, it's pretty simple to go to the next step and learn how to relax it and bring it to good health. And then, once the back is okay, I've been encouraging people to focus on your shoulders. It seems that many people have stress, tightness in the muscles of their shoulders. To be able to relax those muscles, we use a bit of awareness on those feelings and a bit of visualization. You can imagine your shoulder muscles to be a bunch of strings, and those strings are being stretched on either end, pulled until they're tight, they're under strain. And on both sides of your shoulders, you imagine the strings being stretched. And now you imagine just letting go of both ends of those strings. Letting them go. If you visualize that, actually the muscles will follow. The real muscles, and the muscles relax. And your awareness, your mindfulness, notices a different feeling, which is very easy to recognize as the muscles have relaxed. They're more at ease. So you don't get pain in that area when you're meditating, especially for long periods of time. Your awareness has given you the skill of relaxing your own shoulders. And then you may move up to the throat. Thank you, whoever coughed, because that's what I was going to talk about. Coughing. Sometimes it's natural. People have allergies or just coughs. And so, if you have to cough, please do so. Because if you suppress that cough, if you hold it in, you will find that we have in meditation what we call a volcano effect. A volcano effect is when you decide, no, I'm not going to cough, I'm going to disturb people that way. So you hold it in, you hold it in, you hold it in. It just builds up pressure. And it builds up so much pressure, it's going to blow. And when it does blow, that is a big noise. And also, just like a volcano, it spreads all this toxic spray over the people who sit around. So that's what I call a volcano effect of meditation. So just cough before it gets really bad. Wow. So many people coughing, huh? Excellent. But then, if it's not so bad, you can put awareness on that irritation of the throat. You're from where the cough comes from. You feel it. Mindful of it. What makes it worse? What makes it ease off? And you'll find that if you try and control the irritation which causes the coughs, if you are afraid of it, you'll find it gets worse. You tense up with the irritation, and it gets so bad sometimes it does end up with a big cough. However, if you feel that irritation and learn how to be kind to it, you find the intensity of the irritation gets less and less and less and less. Just like I learned as a child, I was in Acton. Whenever I would play soccer, go for a tackle, graze the skin off my knees, I go run to my mother, "Mummy, mummy, I'm bleeding." And in pain too. And all she would do was kneel down and put her lips to the wound and kiss it better. Her mouth full of germs on a local wound. Never ever got infected. But more importantly, just a little act of kindness and compassion took all the pain away. I remember that. I just slap a band-aid on and out playing soccer again. Now, that's just like irritations. Give them kindness and they get less. So give kindness to your throat. Not controlling. And your mindfulness, which gives you feedback, might notice the irritation gets less and less and less. You're learning a valuable skill of mindfulness and compassion, what I call kindfulness, eases and heals. Then I go up to my head. Make sure it's well balanced on top of the neck, not too far forward, not too far back, not to the left, not to the right. Just middle way. And especially, I just got into the habit of being aware of the muscles around my eyes. Because if I'm tired or if I'm afraid, those muscles tense up. They get tight. It's so easy to learn how to relax those muscles. When you're kind, you don't try and worry about anything. You just let things be. You can feel the muscles relax, and it's a sensation which is easy to notice. And you keep on relaxing those muscles, the mindfulness giving you feedback, until the muscles are totally relaxed. With those relaxed muscles, much of the emotions behind that just get softened. And then before I leave my body to go into the emotional world of the mind, I just look, somewhere in my body there's always something which is irritating. An ache or a pain, stomach ache, some sort of wound which is aching. There was something. So I focus on the most irritating, disturbing feeling in my body. Just zoom in on it. So I almost like fill my mind just with that tiny area of my body which isn't feeling good. I'm aware of that sensation, that ache, that pain. Whatever it is, you don't need to give it a name, just be aware of it. And then I give it kindness, opening the door of my heart to that irritation. If it truly is compassion, then that feeling the irritating feeling softens, the pain gets less. Because in mindfulness, always looking at that one area, sees what works and what doesn't. Sees the cause which gives rise to deep relaxation in that one part of the body, and sees the attitude of mind which makes things more tense and tight and more inflamed. Oh, it's compassion, letting things be, non-judgmental awareness. That's what relaxes everything. I do that on my body first. Until my body feels so deeply relaxed, so at peace, it's a delightful feeling. Train myself to actually be able to notice that delightful feeling and even indulge in it. Because I know from experience what happens is when you are aware of the delightful feeling of a relaxed body, the relaxation goes deeper. Totally at ease and relaxed in this moment with your body. It's not only good for the health and energy, it's also strengthening these two important qualities of meditation, awareness and kindness. And then I let the body go. And I ask myself, how peaceful are you, or how agitated? So to get to know what I mean, you may ask yourself, how agitated, or no, how peaceful am I? From 1 to 10, give a number to yourself. 1 means extremely peaceful, 10 means really agitated. Be honest. It's only you knowing. So how peaceful and how agitated are you? This is a skillful means by which you can know something I call the peaceometer in your mind. Just like a speedometer in a car, a thermometer on the wall which tells you the temperature. This is telling you how peaceful you are or how disturbed. You're aware of that, and after a while you become very, very skilled at noticing that quality. You're putting the mindfulness on one of the most important parts of your emotional world. How peaceful, how agitated you are. And as you are mindful, aware of your own peaceometer, what makes that needle go up so you're getting more agitated? What makes a needle go down so you're getting more peaceful? You'll find when you strive, when you want, when you long for something, or you really try to get rid of something, that needle just goes up and up and up, more and more agitated. But when you let things be, when you open the door of your heart for this moment, when you abandon all wanting, all expectations, and realize this is good enough, I'm just happy to be here, then you find you get peaceful. You're learning how to be still. Not through wanting or struggling, but by just being. Kindness, present moment, just being here with unconditional awareness. Being aware, not judging. As you do that, you find the peaceometer really moves further and further away from irritation, closer and closer to deep stillness. Really being still. And if you think you are still, notice the delight of a still mind, a peaceful mind. There's no burdens, no worries, free. Just like you used to be when you were a child, playing. No even thoughts of the future. No real memories of the past. In the present moment, at peace and happy. It may very well be, at this time, you become aware of things like the breathing, the experience of the breath going in and out of your body. It's actually a natural occurrence. So if you are aware of the breath, your breathing now, just be aware of it, but don't control it. Your job is not to tell it what to do. Your job is to be a friend to your breathing. Be a friend, not a control freak. Then you find it stays with you. If you like, you can do the little technique, breathing in peace. Breathe out, let go. Whatever is bothering you, sickness, ill health, weakness, whatever, breathe that out with every out-breath. As you breathe in health, peace, love, freedom, whatever it is you want to breathe in, something positive, let that come in with every in-breath. Feel it. With every part of an in-breath, from beginning to end. Breathe out sickness, tension, whatever, with every out-breath, from beginning to the end. Breathing in peace, breathing out in breath. I'm now going to be quiet for a few minutes. Either be aware of the breathing, or just be aware of the peace officer.
So as you close to the end of this meditation, how do you feel? How's that piece of react to this yet? So don't move yet. Just another minute or two. How do you feel? How's the piece of it? How still are you? And why? What actually works? Not what monks like me tell you, but from your own direct experience, what makes that peaceometer just really go close to one? What does peace feel like? Stillness, clarity. And how does the body feel when the mind is still? When I take my attention away from the body and get very still in the mind, my body just feels so good, so free, no tightness, tension anywhere to be found. This is how we meditate. I guide you, but you learn for yourself. You know, sometimes people in many countries, many places, can't always get close to a temple or a teacher or whatever. This is our long world. You know what you can do these days, which I encourage? You can see things like guided meditation, all recorded. So, you download them on your iPod, iPad, iPhone, or something or other. And once you have downloaded it, any place, any time, whenever you need a guided meditation, you can put the earbuds in and listen to the guided meditation. Which is so useful because we don't always have the time to come to the temple or to a monastery or to a retreat center where the teachings are on. So you can actually get it free on your iPad, iPod, and listen to it anytime you need it as a resource for you. When you're sick, when you're waiting for a doctor's appointment, or whatever, you need to relax. Because sometimes it's hard unless you've been practicing a while to do it for yourself. When you've got your teacher in there, like in your ear, giving these instructions, then it's there for you. Whenever you need, you sort of turn it on, and it's where your eyes close. It's not that much different than actually having a teacher in front of you. So the teacher is there with you in your car, in your home, on the aircraft, whenever you need it, even on the toilet. So it's not disrespectful if it's what you need at that time. So the Buddha will go everywhere with you, and I'm very happy to go with you on the toilet bowl. Not physically, but on the recordings. That's why when I was in the United States a couple of months ago, I realized that's what they call, you know, the toilets, the restrooms. To take a rest. So it can't be just for sort of doing your business. That's why I also tell people, if you're really busy at work, and you can't find the time to do some meditation, you can't find a place to do meditation. That's what the restrooms are there for, to take a rest. So you can go there, lock yourselves in, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, however long you need. And if other people say, what were you doing there for 20 minutes? Such a long time. The answer is obvious, you were constipated. It's not lying. It's just another way of saying what happens when your mind is stuffed up and does not flow freely. We don't know how to let go. Well, that's true. So anyway, that's how we can make use of the meditation. Now, the topic of the talk is supposed to be dealing with uncertainty, making peace with uncertainty.
Now already, oh, I don't think I have said this yet, that this part of the meditation, which I always say, whatever you're aware of, just make peace with it, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. With whatever you are experiencing in life. Because you know, sometimes people used to tell me, well, it's okay to meditate when I'm feeling good, when I'm not sick, when I'm not having some fever. You know, then I can meditate, but you know, sometimes, you know, you're sick, you know, sometimes you're going through some operation or you feel terrible. How do I meditate then? Can't even cross my legs. It hurts. And I said, look, you don't know what meditation is if you think you have to be watching your breath or visualizing something. Because the heart of meditation is no matter what you're experiencing, no matter what that is, just make peace with it. Don't fight it, don't make war, trying to get rid of stuff. Make peace with it. So I remember when people said, I think they had some fever or whatever, the flu or whatever. Can you make peace with that flu, that feeling, that tiredness? Can you make peace with it? Of course you can. You can make peace with anything. Can you be kind to it, care for it? Of course you can. Can you be gentle? Of course you can. This is basic Buddhism, all traditions. Compassion, peace, kindness. But if you make war with your body, with your mind, you know what happens? What George W. Bush used to call collateral damage. You hurt things. But when you make peace, be kind, be gentle, it's called good karma. Good meditation karma. You make peace, be kind, be gentle. Now, the results are you have peace, you have freedom, you have joy afterwards. But if you try and fight the body, fight the sickness, that is making bad meditation karma. And you're going to get trouble afterwards. So actually, you can meditate any place, any time, in any condition, whatever you're feeling, if you know how to do it. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. For those of you who haven't heard me before, that is the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So, that is how we can meditate anywhere, anytime. And in particular, with anything in life, to make peace with it. Sometimes, you know, it's very frightening life, the uncertainties of life. You have cancer, you're losing all your money, your relationship is breaking down, your temple is burning, you can't pay the bills. Ah, what should I do? And I like to use stories, anecdotes from my own life, to illustrate now how these actually work, how you can make peace with anything, with really fear, uncertainty, and how the results are really unexpected and usually entirely positive. And that was the anecdote. I was a school teacher once before I became a monk in a high school in Devon. Yeah, it was a beautiful part of the world, but kids being kids, teenagers being teenagers, after 1 year of teaching teenagers in a high school, that was it. Time to leave the world. I'd had enough. It's really stressful and hard work. But obviously there's many experiences you have which teach you life lessons. And one of those experiences was when the English teacher, the head of the English department in this school in Devon, was just chatting, and he said that he was in the British Army during the Second World War. You know, didn't really want to be a soldier, but everyone had to volunteer. And he was in Burma, in the jungles, fighting Japanese. You know, not, he wasn't serious, but you know, that's what he had to do. So there he was on patrol with a few other soldiers. They had a scout, and the scout came back and said, we're in big trouble, because they had wandered into a huge number of enemy soldiers. And the scout said they were completely surrounded, there was no way out, and really heavily outnumbered. This was war. And he thought, this is his end. He's going to die. Thousands of miles from his home,
fighting a war which he just had to, which he really wasn't didn't want to do, and they're about to die, surrounded by so many soldiers, and only a few of them know we have. But he told me, I think I believe this, that sometimes no one knows who's going to be the hero. And he had this surge of heroism, and he said, let's fight our way out. It's better than just sitting here waiting to be shot and killed. Let's fight our way out. Who knows? Someone might escape. And if we don't, at least we can take some of the enemy with us into death. That's the die-hard school of getting out of difficult situations. Might work in Hollywood, but it doesn't work in real life. So he wanted to fight his way out. But his captain was far wiser. He said, no, we will not fight. Put down your weapons. Instead, we will all have a cup of tea. It was the British Army. And you may laugh at that, but that was one of the wisest things that he ever did. It saved his life. It was orders at war in an army. You had to follow them, no matter how crazy they seemed at the time. Sometimes that people think, no, it's wrong work, it's crazy. But sometimes we don't appreciate the skillful means which has been developed in the British Army over many centuries. We've been trouble to sit down and have a cup of tea. We don't like tea, have a coffee. We don't like coffee, have some apple juice or whatever. But what they did, they had to do that. And in the time it took them to just make a cup of tea, not even finish it yet, the scout came back and said, put away everything quickly, silently. The enemy has moved. There's a way through. Let's go for it. And of course, he escaped without any injury. So did every one of those soldiers. When they were surrounded with death impending, the worst possible thing, instead of panicking, when there was nothing to do, they did nothing. Simple, logical. But a lot of times people just cannot do that. And they waited. They waited in the knowledge that everything is uncertain. It's impermanent. It changes. It will never be the same from one moment to the next. Let's wait until there is an opportunity where we can do something positive. And that's what they did. That's how to make peace with uncertainty. Wait. Knowing things are always changing in flux. And instead of wasting your life, your energy or whatever, fighting a battle which you cannot win, which is going to harm you and others, you wait, you pause. Knowing that later on it will not be the same and you can take your chances and have a much better chance of actually getting through the difficult times. So he told me he owed his life to that captain, or the wisdom, not just once but many times. He told me that once he had cancer, inoperable, terminal, no opportunity, no possibility of getting better. And what did he do? Sat down and had a cup of tea. Can't fight it. So just let it be. And because he didn't fight it, get more tense, you know, with the impending death, he started to get better. And he eventually got through to remission. He survived. And he often told me that if he tried to fight his cancer, do battle with it, he'd probably be dead. It was a stress-caused disease, and you add more stress to it, obviously it gets worse. So those were the thoughts that ideas which he was telling me, which actually work in real life, which is how we deal with uncertainty. We turn it to our advantage. Life is uncertain. So, go with the uncertainty rather than trying to force the flow of life according to our will, according to our plans. We never know what's going to happen next. And quite honestly, I never plan my talks. Even earlier, the Venerable Chandra asked me, do you remember what you're going to talk about tonight? And I actually, he had to remind me a few minutes before. So every time, yeah. So I don't know what I'm going to talk about. Sometimes you have the title of the talk and I talk about something completely different. I'm a student, a great fan of Monty Python, and now for something completely different. Is that fun? It's much more fun that way. Anyway. If you have a book, do you go straight to the ending first of all and find out the ending, who did it? Of course not. Otherwise it would be just so boring and just predictable. Life is uncertain, you're uncertain, I'm uncertain, and I celebrate that. I don't try and even make peace with it. I love it. It's life. Joyful. You don't know whatever is going to happen next. Otherwise, life is dead. Predictable. Fated. Destined. What sort of life is that? If my life was destined from the beginning, and I can't do anything about it, I might as well just go to bed and go to sleep. What's the point of any effort? It's going to happen anyway. But you know that that's not what life is. It is uncertain, which means there's something you can always do. For example, there was a lady who came on my first talk in Chiswick, and she had it was her daughter who was, I'm not quite sure what the condition was in a wheelchair and was very hard to actually to talk to. And, she said, was this the karmic result of something bad she did in her life, having to live like this? And of course, as a traditional Buddhist, I said, absolutely not. And I told her the simile of the law of karma, which actually shows what we're actually doing here. And the uncertainty of life gives us opportunities. So I said the simile of baking a cake. Two people have two different sets of ingredients. One has really amazing ingredients. The very, very best whole wheat flour, organically grown, free range wheat, whatever that means. We know what I'm talking about. With no free trade, with no sort of genetically modified crops within 1,000 miles of the field. And no, packaged in paper from a forest certified resuscitatable. You know, sorry?
Sustainable.
Yes, thank you. What a busy day. But it doesn't make much more fun when you make a mistake, brother. Sustainable fine. And the very best you could possibly get. And they got this, and not sugar, but honey from Australia. I've got to justify to my government why I come over here. So I'm advertising the amazing honey from my state. And they have fruit, amazing fruit from Portugal, you live. But from Portugal, that's where Heather comes from. So I'm her friend now. And what else do you need for fruit? Eggs. Salmonella free eggs from the UK. So I actually read that, so it's actually salmonella free eggs now when I was at my cousin's. So, the very best ingredients. And I know there's a few people from Poland here,
And there is a modern kitchen. They're from the best designers, the kitchen manufacturers in Poland. So they've got the very, 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 very best. And the other person's got the very worst ingredients. They have got genetically modified flour with lots of pesticides. They have, which they can't get out somewhere. And they've got diabetically enriched sugar, cholesterol enhanced margarine or something, full of chemicals. And what's the other one they've got in? Oh, they've got, yeah, that's. They've got Frankenstein fruit, which is so old that it's so hard that the British Army could use them instead of bullets. So hard. And they've got this pre-World War kitchen to cook it in. That's the First World War, not the Second World War kitchen. Really old. Who makes the best cake? And it's not always a person with the best ingredients, is it? Because just the ingredients you've got to work with in life, that's, you know, helpful. But the most important part in cooking is the love and care, the energy, the patience which you put into those cooking. And I tell that story a lot, but when I was in Singapore once, in the Singapore Straits Times, they reported that Jamie Oliver, or somebody like that, was in Singapore, and they had a little competition with the street hawkers. The food is, you know, sold in food courts and stuff on the streets. They asked them to cook something, and Jamie Oliver to cook something. He could get his own ingredients. They had to, you know, whatever they could afford. And they had the general public, who didn't know who this white fellow was, cooking. The general public would compare the same food, who made the most delicious dim sum or something. And it was the street hawkers would always win. Why? Because if you go to that part of Asia, the competition is so cutthroat, so tough, that to survive you have to really put so much energy and effort and love and care and skill into what you're doing. Jamie Oliver, he can do anything and still gets paid a fortune. But it's not what the skill you have and the ingredients, it's what you do with them. So that is the uncertainty principle. That the ingredients you have in life, you know, where you come from, your intelligence, your skills, your health, your status in life, your finances, your physical strength or your disabilities. That's not what a disability is. You're disabled if you don't know how to make use of what you have. And, you know, sometimes in my life I've met what some people call disabled and I call, wow, you have made so much with what you have that you are richer than I am. For example, when I was in Cambridge University, this is, I own up to this, I was a Buddhist, you know, when I was only 16. And so that I was a Buddhist when I was in college, and everybody knew that. I had a couple of friends who were Christians, and, you know, we would discuss things together. And one day they came to me and said, we're going to Bulbon Hospital to do some voluntary work in the occupational therapy ward with people with Down syndrome. And I thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? The Christians are going. I'd better go too. And it was not compassion. It was not self-sacrificing. It was just conceit. If the Christians can do it, I'd better do it too. Keeping up with the Joneses. Honestly, that was my idea at the time. Not very praiseworthy, but that's actually how it began. So when I went,
to do my social service, keep the flag flying for the Dhamma, you know, not being outdone by the other side. So when I did go in there, I was so amazingly surprised. I so much enjoyed going there every Thursday afternoon, long after the Christians left. I kept going for a couple of years. And actually they told me, of all the students I'd ever known, I was the most regular who went there the most. And I told them, why? Look, what are you talking about? I look forward to this every Thursday afternoon. I was living with conceited students, I was one of them, and with professors who thought they were so smart. But these people were supposed to be disabled. They were some of the most intelligent people I'd ever met. Emotional intelligence. I didn't know that word then. But you know, sometimes you can hang out with Nobel laureates in the college system. And I could also hang out with some of these people who were said to be disabled, Down syndrome. But the ones I would prefer to hang out with were the with Down syndrome. And it happened, I remember, that just had an argument split up with a girlfriend the night before. Yeah, he just, the young man, he was really depressed, down in the dumps, grumpy. And these Down syndrome people, geniuses I should have said, they would see me straight away and immediately suss me out and come running towards me and give me a big hug. I said, how do you know that? They were emotionally so sensitive. And incredible just what they did and how effective that was. And if I had any skills as a man, as a monk, with emotional intelligence, they were my gurus, they were my teachers, they were my masters. I remember them. Because they taught me so much. So were they disabled? Other people might say so. Maybe not treated fairly, but they had so much to say, so much to teach. So, no, I wouldn't say they're disabled. They should be everyone included in. You can learn so much, share so much. It's arrogant to think they're disabled and we are not. So actually, quite frankly, I think professors, especially of things like philosophy, and Nobel Prize laureates, I think they should have access to the disabled car parking place. One of my friends in Malaysia just finished his PhD in psychology. He said, what PhD means? Permanent head damage. Please excuse me, there's a few doctors in here, or PhDs for sure. But what he was doing is the uncertainty. I was allowing myself to actually, all that I'd been taught and led to believe and brainwashed, I was actually challenging it. It was uncertain. Maybe it wasn't true. And I was learning to actually to see things in a different way. So what, to me, maybe thought was a tragedy, turned out to be actually a blessing, a benefit. It was uncertain. And so, if you don't know just where emotional intelligence is, where other things are, my goodness, life is so uncertain. We don't make peace with uncertainty. We actually celebrate uncertainty. We enjoy it. It gives us so many opportunities to see things in a different way, challenge old perceptions, and learn to be wise and kind in a way we never ever thought. Look at me. I just work my butt off traveling all over the place serving other people. And sometimes, if you look at the amount of things which I do and sacrifice and work which I don't really need to do, some people say, I've got many, many friends from Vajrayana, from Mahayana, and they say, Ajahn Brahm, you're more bodhisattva than I am. Well, I'm Hinayana, I'm Theravada. I said, yeah, but they call me, some of my Mahayana monks say, you're a Theravada on the outside with a Mahayana heart inside. I thought that's actually quite nice. But what it really, I don't care, which, you know my tradition anyway, most of you. My tradition is, I try to combine things. So, there are the three traditions, the three vehicles, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. So, combine them, but what can you call it? So, I can take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the last word, the Yana from Vajrayana. And what does that spell? Hahayana. Yeah, exactly, you're Hahayana too, you laugh. So that's what my tradition is, Hahayana. What about my name, Ajahn Brahm? You know what that means, Brahm? B for Buddhist, R for Roman Catholic, A for Anglican, H for Hindu, and M for Muslim. So what do you do that for? Uncertain. Can you actually pin a person down, who they are, what they are? If you do, for example, do you know your partner? Do you know them? You may have lived with them for so many years. Do you really know them? If you do, your relationship is dead. It's like you read the book, you know the ending. Do you keep reading that book? Or you take it back to the library or give it to somebody else? What are you doing with the book, isn't it? How many times do you have to see the movie before you're fed up with seeing it again? It's amazing that you don't even know yourself. How can you know your partner? A few days ago, actually just about maybe 2 weeks ago now, oh, 10 days, I decided, because I'm 66 now, to apply for, this is Australian, Commonwealth Seniors Card. I don't know if I get any extra benefits because, as I tell about the mark, I get meals on wheels every day. You know, all the devotees, they come with big food from Tantra or Monastery in their cars. It's called Meals on Wheels. I won't get a pension anyway. You don't need it. Don't do money, as I tell about the Buddhist monks. So what benefits you get getting a seniors card? You get into the movies or cut price. Can't go to movies. So what benefits do you get? And I thought, well, you know, I might get a little respect. Pretty much seeing you. What I just did is, you know, I had the form there, so instead of getting rid of the form, I might as well use it. But the trouble was, I had to go to the office. I'm not sure what they call it in the UK, they call it Centrix, Social Security, whatever. The same as the Dole office, the same place. And so I went there, and they said, well, we need ID first of all. You need to prove who you are. And as soon as they said that, I started contemplating. You mean I have to prove who I am? For 43 years I haven't found the answer to that question. This is going to be difficult. Then, well, at least the identification. Oh, women, what do you have to get? Passport? I actually have that. Here's my passport. But then you need more identification. We need your driving license. So I haven't got a driving license. I'm a mother, don't drive cars. And there's a good reason for that. I remember when somebody showed me the advertisement for Mercedes car. They had a Tibetan monk driving, he was going all over the road. You know, if you didn't know what he was up to, you'd think he was right, swerving this way, swerving that way. And he was wanting to avoid the bucks on the road. So that's one of the reasons why Buddhist monks are nice car drive. You know, you go this way, that way, that way, and this way. To avoid destroying life. But anyway, so I've got a driving license, so your bank card. I haven't got a bank card. I don't have a bank account. Well, what about your marriage license? That comes to it. What about your mental agreement?
they walk into agreement with that. What else do they ask for? They ask for so much. I said, we don't have that. You know, amongst them, we're married, we don't have bank accounts, we don't have driving license. He said, well, it's like you don't exist. I said, yes, that's the answer. I don't know in this place here, in this temple, but in our monastery, so many monks, we have to have, like, we do like a buffet service. We put all the food on tables, have it offered, and then the monks go in line, like a buffet. But we always have to have two lines in a Buddhist monastery. Two lines. We have those who are enlightened and those who aren't. Because those who are not enlightened have to do self-service, and those who are enlightened do no self-service. That's why I'm always a bit concerned when people want photographs and they say, can I do a selfie? I say, no, you can't. You can do a no selfie. So anyway, the uncertainty of our life, I celebrate that. Which means you see someone and you don't know who they are. And you allow them to be different than your expectations. You can look at someone and say, I don't know you. It's wonderful I don't know you. I celebrate that. Because you're unpredictable. You know, sometimes if you look at someone and you've had problems with them before, that you expect sort of to get angry. But if you look at them, people who you thought were terrible, awful people, you look at them, forgetting the past anger and hurt which you've had at their hands, or by their speech, you look at them and say, I don't know what you're going to do today. It gives the opportunity, the space, for them to surprise you. Terrible people can be good, and good people can make mistakes. You can't put people in a box. They're uncertain. And that's wonderful that they are. It's nice being unpredictable. Unfortunately, my unpredictability is pretty predictable these days. When I came in here, I was hiding at the back. Just for fun. You know, sometimes it's nice, it's fun, you know, to do things differently. This one story, you know, just be uncertain. Who are you? So this one time, I remember I was helping the other monks do some building work. Getting myself dirty, shoveling concrete. I love concrete trucks. I've got a fetish about cement. I'm a boy, okay? You like to get dirty, you like to get in there and shovel and build and get all cement marks all over your face. So I was just indulging, helping us. It needed to be done anyway, so helping with the other monks, even though at that time I was really senior. And when we finished, I was walking back from the building site to my hut to get a shower and to change my robes to something a bit more respectable. Because they were all sort of in the work clothes, they were just all sort of dirty and stained. So anyway, as I was walking to the shower, against Sri Lankans. It was a Sri Lankan girl who was a very high class Sri Lankan lady, because she was obviously wearing a very expensive sari and so many bangles on her wrist that when I heard her coming from a distance, I thought it was the ice cream truck. That's what it sounded like. And so I couldn't avoid her,
she was coming past me, and so she stopped me and said, I'm looking for Ajahn Brahm. And thinking very quickly, I said, well, he's probably seen in the room over there in about 15 minutes. He's going to be there here, probably. And so off she went. And I had a shower, changed my robes. I went to see her. And you know, she didn't recognize me? Not at all, because I talked a bit of Dharma, Buddhism, meditation, what we were doing. And she was really impressed. So she said, wow, you know, there's a wonderful teaching, really good monk, wonderful monastery. But if you don't mind me saying, there's one thing I thought I should bring to your attention. On my way here, I saw one of your monks who was very badly dressed and dirty. That's not appropriate for a monk to look like that. You know, you can tell your monks that they have much better dress and be more clean and more respectable. If you don't mind me saying that, a tiny criticism. So, you saw a monk like that here? Wow! Okay, madam, I will speak to him later about it. That's not right, I don't want to speak to myself. But it's wonderful playing different roles. Because it's actually, I don't know why people just keep taking photographs of me. Honestly, when I was in Indonesia, I was told that the Buddhist monument, Borobudur, in the central Java, is incredibly beautiful for students. That so many people were taking flash photographs of that wonderful monument, they had to ban it because the flashlight was actually degrading the stonework. Same thing's happening to me. So I don't know what I'm going to look like, you know, next time I go to Indonesia, all degraded. But, so celebrating uncertainty, you never know what's going to happen next. Never once, when I first became a monk, I thought I was going to go off into a nice forest, a nice cave, and just disappear from the world and live happily ever after. Just vanish. And I get up to such crazy things these days. The next crazy thing I'm going to do, totally uncertain, I never in my wildest dreams thought I was ever going to do something like this. So we're having a debate in Cambridge on Thursday the 9th of November. And there's like a debate in this Cambridge Union Debating Society. His Holiness Dalai Lama's been there. But they're having a debate on, they have a motion, a proposition. This house has lost faith in faith. And they wanted me to speak for the motion. And I'm a monk, I'm a religious person. I've got to actually argue that we've lost faith in faith. And my adversary, the one I'm arguing against, betting against, is Russell Brand. And he's arguing for faith. It's really weird, isn't it? Totally crazy. I like crazy stuff. Totally uncertain. And just celebrating the uncertainty of what you have to do as a Buddhist monk in a modern world. You know, how is all my uncertainty? You just go with it. He's not the greatest of fun. There's one fellow who comes to our meditation class, and he was a radio producer. And he was in a local radio station. They do these late night talkback shows. So he said, you know, you can think on your feet. You can give some strange answers. Can I get you to come on my radio show, talk about it? I said, yeah, sure. You know, but I'm really busy. But I really wanted to do that. I've never done that before, like talk about radio. So let's give it a try. After 43 years as a monk, you know, you get bored with the normal stuff. So you know, this is something a bit more interesting. Why not? Spread, you know, your experience a bit. This also gives you wonderful stories to talk, you know, at this center afterwards. It gives you material, which makes people interesting. So anyway, that topic comes after the usual talk I used to give on a Friday night. So I arrived at the studio 10 p.m. and on Friday night, and it was really late. And you know, I just got into the studio, I had to rush into the studio and feel the beam on radio. You got the microphone in front of you, you put your headphones on, the red light goes on. You haven't got time to be introduced. I just made it with seconds to spare. So I'm sitting down relaxing, and the presenter of the program, welcome this evening to our listeners. And today we have two special guests. And the first special guest is Professor Gabriel Morrissey, who has written so many best-selling books on sexual dysfunction and adult problems.
And I said, what program have I got myself into? Am I in the right studio? But it was too late. I had headphones on, and the microphone was in front of me live, the red light was flashing, recording live.
And then they asked me my name. They can't pronounce that. I went to one girls' school once, and then I saw some of the girls from that school, a high school in Perth, the next couple of days. And they came up to say, thanks for coming to our school yesterday. I said, you remember me? I said, yes, we'll never forget a monk called Ajahn Brah.
There's an M on here.
It's M on the end, not Ra. They're just winding me up having fun. So I enjoyed it, told everyone about it. But they couldn't pronounce that, so they called me Mr. Monk. So here's Mr. Monk from the monastery just down in the hills, and also Dr. Gabriel Morrissey. So there I was, by that time, celibate for over 30 years, having to field questions from the general public about stuff I knew nothing about. But that has never stopped me. It didn't stop me then, it doesn't stop me now. But the weird thing was, because you knew psychology, that were human beings, the answers which I was giving were actually, they were so good, they had to be so good, because people were ringing from the general public and they'd ask me, and this expert, this professor, no one was asking her anything. She was just sitting there, just no work to do. At the end of the session, 2 hours, she got the check, I just got a bar of chocolate. And that was really mean. That's what monks are like, except I was to give them a cup of tea, bar of chocolate, and do anything. Very cheap. So anyway, it was totally absurd. But I always remember one of the questions which came in from a taxi driver. And just, why? When you allow uncertainty, just go with it. But you don't know what you're supposed to say. You haven't been trained. You don't allow that learning to stand in the way of truth. The taxi driver just rang up and he said, Mr. Monk, I'm married. Taxi driver late at night between fares. I'm married, I'm having an affair with someone else. Is that okay? That was his question. Is that all right? And so straight away I replied, sir, if it was all right, you would not be ringing me up to ask. And he hung up. I got him straight away. I nailed him. Because that's why he was ringing up. If it was all right, why would he need to ask an expert? He felt guilty. And he wanted somebody else, some authority, to make him feel good, to take away his obvious feeling that he was really doing something hurtful for his wife. That's obvious. So sometimes when you don't know what you're supposed to say, and you just react in the moment, you actually get it straight away. That's why I like uncertainty. Being put on the spot, no preparation, you do a far better job. Many doctors, professors, people who are put in a difficult situation for which they've never been really prepared, they put aside their knowledge and they go to uncertainty and they feel what needs to be done. And that feeling of uncertainty
is far more reliable. You come up with solutions, with actions, which are really intuitive, original, and effective. My master at Gansharan was always totally unpredictable. So uncertain that it was great seeing how this totally unpredictable monk will deal with really difficult crises. And one story which shows that how he dealt with uncertainty, not being trained, and how beautiful and amusing it was. We had a couple of villagers come early in the morning to see him. There was a lady in the village who had been possessed by some demon, and they were very, very violent demons. And this woman was being brought to see the great teacher Ajahn Chah. Maybe Ajahn Chah could fix it. And I was there at the time, and that you could hear the woman being dragged into the monastery. She was shouting obscenities. Now, what sort of a respectable Buddhist would never ever do in the presence of a temple, especially with a holy monk like Ajahn Chah, saying terrible things. And you may notice how tough farmers that is. But Thai farmers, about four or five of them, were needed to hold her down, to drag her to see Ajahn Chah. When a person is so psychotic, they have a huge strength. And so, as soon as Ajahn Chah saw that, he told a couple of novice monks, "Dig a hole, dig a hole, I need a big hole dug. And you, boil some water, I need lots and lots and lots of boiling water." I had no idea what Ajahn Chah was up to. I mean, totally unpredictable, totally uncertain. There's a crazy person there. What are you digging a hole and boiling water for? And as they draw her closer, you can see her big eyes, foaming in the mouth, incredible strength, shouting obscenities at Ajahn Chah. And all Ajahn Chah did, "Dig a hole, I need a big hole, and I need lots and lots and lots of boiling water, more boiling water, come on, I need it fast." And again, no one knew what he was up to. Until he said, "That demon inside that woman is very, very dangerous. The only thing to be able to do is to throw that woman into that hole, pour all the boiling water over her, and bury her. That's the only way we can deal with such a dangerous demon." That's what he said. Totally unpredictable, this monk. Now, I've known that monk for a long time at that occasion. And even I thought, he may actually do that. But more importantly, that woman thought he will do that. And what happened next was just so amazing. Because that woman knew she didn't get her act together fast, she'd be in that hole with boiling water poured all over and then buried alive. She calmed down. In 1 or 2 minutes, she was sitting there, exhausted, but totally still and peaceful. And Ajahn Chah gave her a blessing, and she walked away. That was just so unpredictable, so amazing to see. How a person, you know, with no training, but incredible psychology, knew that underneath that possession, or whatever it was, or that psychosis, was a more powerful force of self-preservation, fear of pain, and managed to leverage that so she had to get her act together, she had to calm down. Or something terrible would happen to her. That's what she did. Beautiful to see that. You can't imitate that. If you do that, you go to jail. But he could do that because dealt with incredible uncertainty. Your life. I never thought I'd ever be going to teach at the 2015 World Computer Conference. That was a couple of years ago. To give all these weird talks. And to actually to make something out of it. Never thought I'd be giving so much. I thought I'd be retiring now. I'm over 60. 65 is supposed to retire in Australia. But I found out the monks, don't retire at all. They're not really a holy man until you're at least 70. Life begins at 70 for a Buddhist monk. And none. So that's a yoga exercise. If I can't get away with it, I don't see why you should. So that uncertainty, make a peace with it now. Celebrate it. It tests you, it makes life alive, you never know what's going to happen next. But never sort of be overwhelmed by uncertainty. It's an opportunity. It's a growth, it's a learning. Accept it. If everything was certain again, you would be dead. There'd be no life. There'd be no learning. If you knew the answer to the exam the night before you took the exam, what's the point? So you never know what's happening next. Which means the future is there for you to make. You have ingredients. What are you going to make with them? That uncertainty means you never need to get depressed, to get negative, to feel you want to blame someone, get angry at someone. Because whatever it is, the ingredients of your life, there's always something positive you can do with it. The future is uncertain. You don't know which way it's going to go. When I was young, that we always thought there'd be a nuclear war between Soviet Union and Reagan's America. Never happened. Who knows what's going to happen next? The future is in your hands. Karma, you're creating it. You can do anything. Uncertainty is another word for opportunity. Another call for you to get your bumps off the seat and do something. This particular man used to say, don't just do something, sit there. But there is a time when you have to do something. Why not? So it's amazing. In uncertainty, you don't know what's going to happen next. So if the doctor ever comes up to you and says, you're going to die soon. You've got brain cancer. I know so many examples of people that are supposed to be dead, they're still alive. They're supposed to die 20 years ago. The doctor said they've only got a couple of months to live. What are these stories? Totally against what people think. I like being a rebel, challenging people's ideas of what should be. And that's a scientist, okay. So, Ted from Yorkshire. No, that's right, I've got this one. Ted from Lancashire. I said this yesterday. Ted from Lancashire. You know, he was a smoker, and then he got lung cancer eventually. You can't blame anything, because everybody smoked in those days. He got lung cancer, so he went into our hospice in Australia to die. You know, hospices are where you go, palliative care, make the dying as peaceful, as comfortable as possible. So, he told me, I went to visit him after the first day, and he said, the night before, the nurse had said, Ted, what do you want for dinner tonight? So Ted said, well, I've got high cholesterol, so I can't have anything oily. I've got hardened arteries, so cut out the salt. I've got diabetes, so no sugar, nothing sweet. And the nurse looked at him and said, Ted, you're not going to die of a heart attack or a stroke from cholesterol. You're not going to die because of hard arteries. Diabetes is not going to get you. Cancer is within a few days. So you can eat whatever you like. And his eyes went wide. You mean I can eat all my favorite greasy, oily food with lots of sugar and syrup and heaps of salt? Yes. So all the food which his wife wouldn't let him eat for the past 3 years, he ordered in excess. And about a week later, Ted walked out of that hospice. The cancer had decreased so much, he had another 6 months of life before he went into the hospice and died properly that time. Health food. With no joy, no happiness, uncertainty, who knows? Anyway, there was a little cartoon which we had in our monastery. There was a squirrel and a psychiatrist's office. Squirrel and psychiatrist's office, and the psychiatrist said, "What are you doing here?" to the squirrel. And the squirrel said, "As soon as I realized you are what you eat, I realized I was nuts." Okay, Q&A. So, any questions that people have? Any comments, any complaints? Anyone? Put your hand up if you have a comment or complaint. Questions or whatever. We've got to finish up with this. Any questions? Yes?
Hi there, thanks for the talk. It was great. So I was just wondering about sometimes you've got goals or things you want to achieve.
Oh, yeah.
I find that can make you happy to have things you believe in you're trying to achieve, like the you guys in the Bakunis project.
Yeah.
And it's how do you weigh that up with also letting go and,
yeah,
and not wanting to do that? Because both those things
are
important.
Yeah, they are important, but look, how many days a week do you work?
I agree to get into this and work.
No, look, you do a 40-hour week or 50-hour week or something, that's when you do your work, you do your goals. But for goodness sake, don't do goals, 24-7, you drive you crazy, you get stressed out. So, there are times when I define like goals, especially that after, you know, maybe finish work today, when I go back to have a rest tonight, I always remember, never do today what you can put off till tomorrow, because you might die tonight. Imagine that. You know, you go home this evening and decide, I'm going to wash all the dishes, clean up the house, do all that extra work, and you find out you die tonight. All that for nothing. Nothing. What a waste of an evening. That's going to happen one day. Anyway. Yeah, it's kind of fun to do something, but the goals, it doesn't matter, you know, winning or losing. That's one of the reasons why. I know the English soccer team has only just scraped into the World Cup, the final, whatever it is. But for goodness sake, never get a Buddhist on your soccer team. You find out they're a Buddhist, don't put them in the first team. Who's the coach, the manager? Anyway, whoever it is, tell them, no Buddhists otherwise. Because what happens if you have a Buddhist on a soccer team? They have no goals, they don't know where to shoot. They have compassion. So the last thing they want to do, you know, as bodhisattvas, is upset the other team. They have letting go. And the other team wants the ball, take it. So yeah, before the Bikuni Monastery, yeah. So half the time I do that, the other time I do nothing. So, when is the time to do something? This is one of Ajahn's great teachings. He said, if you are meditating, give meditation everything you've got. Forget about work, forget about family, cancer, whatever problem. Meditate. Total focus. When you go to work, you're not meditating or discussing Dharma when you're at work. You get sacked by the boss. When you're at work, 100% everything for working.
When you're with your family, the family is the most important thing. Give 100% to your family. When it's time to rest, 100% to resting. Whatever you do in life, you give it everything you've got. And he's talking that to a person in Sydney, and it was so successful, he became very successful in business, wonderful family, great meditator. Whatever he did, in the moment, right now, give everything you've got. When you're walking home or catching a train, give that everything you've got. You don't sort of, you know, go walking onto the platform thinking about sort of letting go or life is uncertain or whatever. You know, just look out for the traffic, look out for the people. And also, whenever you go out from here and you pass the donation box for Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project, give it everything you've got. Okay, so that's what we do. When it's time to let go everything you've got. Yes?
Yeah, you spoke about celebrating uncertainty.
Yeah.
Every day, the look of it on the face is uncertain. So would you say what you're saying is commensurate with the idea you can celebrate the challenge of facing dukkha. So the answer to how we impact dukkha is not to abate desire, but to challenge desire, to celebrate to face,
yes.
Enjoy, celebrate.
You are to understand, explore suffering. Why? Where does it come from? Craving. Why? So, to try and overcome it, get rid of it, makes it bigger, makes it worse. So the uncertainty aspect of life gives us opportunities. Yeah, they do challenge us as well. So we don't look at them as being sort of negative. We don't allow it to cause us fear. And the old story, Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, a great source of philosophy. They must have both been Buddhists. That's why especially Winnie the Pooh was one of my heroes. He was the one who actually taught me bear awareness. Have you heard of bear awareness before? That's what we need to prove. So, he was walking with Piglet in the forest. There was a very, very violent storm. Trees were coming down around them. And so his uncertainty turned to fear. So little Piglet, small guy. And he grabbed Winnie the Pooh's paw, squeezed it so tightly that Winnie the Pooh had to stop walking, and Piglet screamed out, "I'm so afraid! What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it?" That was the uncertainty of walking through a forest during a storm. And the answer was, for Winnie the Pooh, "Yes, but what would happen if a tree didn't fall when we were underneath it?" The uncertainty. Why do we always look at uncertainty with a negative mind? What would happen if? What would we partly say, what would happen if it didn't? And a lot of times, looking at uncertainty with negative mind is what causes the worst to happen. We bring it about, we create what we're afraid of. So that's one way of dealing with uncertainty. It's a challenge, it's interesting, it pushes our learning, we grow more, and it also is something which, you know, should be embraced, and I say, yes, celebrated. Desire is a desire to control, to make everything go according to our plans. That's, for me, that's death. Uncertainty opens so many opportunities. We can make the future, we can create it, only if there's uncertainty about it. There's another question over here which relates. I have a non-Buddhist friend who is to go through, still have to suffer the unfortunate experiences. How can I advise her to make peace with uncertainty? With the unfortunate experiences, I call that walking home from this talk this evening, and on the way home, because you are not really taking much care where you're walking. You tread in a big pile of dog shit and it goes all over your shoes. That's why your friend has gone through so many unfortunate piles of dog shit. How can I advise her to make peace with such things?
This is the content of the cake you're supposed to make.
So what do I mean?
Never ever scrape off the dog shit before you get home. Please take it home with you.
Don't waste it.
And in your home, you may have a garden with an apple tree, pear tree or something. Scrape it off at the root of the apple tree. And 1 year later, your apples will be sweeter and juicier than ever before. And when you bite into that sweet, juicy apple, and the juice goes down your cheek, please remember what you're really eating. You're eating dog shit, transformed into a beautiful apple. You can understand that. So that's an example. Yeah, you've been through many unfortunate experiences. You've been in many piles of dog shit. What are you going to do with that? The uncertainty with regard to those experiences is how you make use of it. You can actually get very negative, depressed. Why me? Or you can dig it into the garden and grow amazing trees of compassion and wisdom. A whole garden with so many beautiful flowers. You give them to the temple, you give them to your friends. So many incredible, delicious fruits, you share them with everybody. The dukkha, the suffering, is where we learn. It's the fertilizer of compassion and wisdom. Honestly, how can you really have compassion, real understanding, if you haven't really been through it yourself? I can sometimes empathize to a point. Say, a woman has been through an abortion. How can I really, I'm a man, how can I really empathize with that? I can only go so far. But if you're being through that, you can actually put your arm around another woman who's just had an abortion. You don't judge them. Most difficult decision a woman ever makes, and basically, men should butt out. They don't know, they can't know why you made the decision to or not to. So, in a case like that, if you've been through it, it's a lot of shit. But at least you know what it is, what it means. And you can actually put your arm around, so I know how you feel. I know I've been there. I know the pain. I know the understandable for a man, just what it's like to have something growing in your womb, and then for one reason or another, you decide to abort it. I can't fathom that. I'm not a woman. You can. That's digging in the shit and growing compassion, understanding, wisdom. You can actually do something and help. That's what I mean. If you've been through terrible experiences, please make use of them. Don't throw them away and get negative. It's an amazing opportunity to grow incredible compassion, inspiration, and wisdom. So, that's the uncertainty. I don't know how you're going to deal with that, but you have the opportunity of dealing with it to the benefit of all sentient beings, or just burying yourself in that shit. That's the uncertainty. Yes, at the back?
I just have a few questions. When you talk about the sense of model, but in plain English, what's a form and formless realm? What does it mean in plain English?
The form and formless realms, those are what happens when the body vanishes and the mind starts to vanish as well. When I was growing up as a lay Buddhist, we didn't have any choice about any tradition. I went to see every teacher there was, because you didn't have much choice. And also, just like, you know, trying to get some muesli, there wasn't any choice in the supermarkets in those days. Whatever they had, you took. And I went up to Sammy Lin years and years and years ago, when Hakon Rinpoche was still there. And I went up to a Zen monastery in Throstle Hole years and years ago. And I remember, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. They put us all with our eyes open facing a whitewashed wall. I was up to anything. I was willing to try anything. So, I didn't know what to do, but at least I knew how to be peaceful, how to not think, and how to be in the moment. So when I did that, what happened was, watching that wall, the wall vanished. It disappeared. It wasn't there anymore. And that was in the late 60s, early 70s. That was cool. Weird was not frightening. Weird was cool. So, wow, this is good. But then I thought, why? Why did that happen? The water just vanished. And then it was just basic science. Your brain can only notice things which change. There's a hum in the background, you won't hear it. A feeling in the body which is always there, you won't sense it. Close your eyes, you see the inside of your eyelids. After a few seconds, you don't see anything at all. Sight vanishes when it's still. Same with your computer. If you don't click the mouse, the screensaver comes on. After a few seconds or minutes, the screensaver just cuts out. No activity means it shuts down. That is your brain. That is your senses. So, what we do in meditation? The body shuts down. You don't see, you don't hear, you don't smell, you don't touch. Your body vanishes. So wonderful, you can't feel anything anymore. Your mind then takes over. The sixth sense. That is what we do in our meditation. Five senses vanish, the sixth sense dominates. And then, the sixth sense, there's nothing much going on, that becomes very still. That starts to disappear. Stage by stage. In, was it Alice in Wonderland? Alice sees the Cheshire Cat. Comes and then vanishes. Appears and vanishes. And Alice says, this is just so disturbing that you keep vanishing and appearing so quickly. And the Cheshire Cat says, okay, I'll vanish slowly. So the Cheshire Cat vanishes, the tail vanishes, the legs vanish, and the head, I think. The ears vanish, the whiskers vanish, the head vanishes, and then the lips vanish, leaving only the smile. And Alice says, I've often seen a cat without a smile, but this is the first time I've seen a smile without a cat. That was a good use of English, but that reminded me what it's like when things disappear. The smile without the cat is a formless mouth. It says the form mouth. And as that disappears, you get to the formless mouth. The great vanishing act. The art of disappearing. Things which we thought were always there vanish, disappear. Like you watch a lake and the waves on the surface of the lake, we think that's coming and going and permanent. But then one day you're sitting by the lake and all the water disappears too. And the lakes and the mountains surrounding it and the sky above it. Everything vanishes. Things which aren't supposed to disappear do vanish. Real emptiness disappears, vanishing. Those are the formless and formless experiences in plain Australia. Yeah, Queen in the back, okay, we've got time. I only have one last question. So who's going to be the Bodhisattva who's going to give up? All given up? Great, so that's no last question. It's got to be great. Thank you so much. Okay, one more, yeah. Put your hand up quickly. Lots of desire. Yes, Craig? Yeah.
I was just wondering how to sort of balance uncertainty with
learning equanimity. So, for example, I've been sick for a long time. It's about 4 years now. I don't know if I'm going to get better or not. You know, it's one of those things. But there's a lot of things that I've had to come to terms with, you know, be kind of try and be equanimous about with it. And I'm just wondering how you kind of balance those, how you balance the acceptance of what's happening, the uncertainty of whether it might or might not get better, and the equanimity of dealing with actually what you're going through now.
Okay, the equanimity is always about the present moment. Make peace, be kind with it. Just embrace it. What you can't, they always, old English saying, if you can't beat it, join it. Be with it. And you actually find that much of the pain and the sickness is actually the mental pain. I don't want this. It's a tough one to say, but if you say, can't do anything about it, I'm going to be with this, it actually changes the whole experience. The Buddha's saying 2 hours, 2 thoughts, the mental and the physical. Physical, you can't do too much about the mental, how you accept it or don't accept it, you can do a lot there. So, you be with it. The worst part of the pain is, I can't stand this any longer, it's too much. You're off in the future. Projecting. This is going to last for a long time, and I just can't handle that. The uncertainty is you don't know if it's going to last for a long time. I've had so many experiences, anecdotal myself and with others, of things not going according to the way the doctors predict. Totally uncertain. You never know what's going to happen next. The head of the medical school at St. Vincent Hospital in Sydney, I got this from one of his doctors, he welcomed the new intake of medical students with the memorable words, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years is wrong. My problem is I do not know which 50% it is. Now that to me is a scientist. Work in progress, not certain at all. Because we just do not know. And if you do know, then you make what you expect. So that, amazing. One day you wake up and the sickness is gone. Why? So much about your body, about karma, you just don't know. So, you have this amazing thing called hope. Don't worry, be hopey. Okay, one more. Okay, very quick, good.
I started to do yoga and meditation a long time ago, and 2 years ago I came to London and I met a friend. And this friend looked like stressed and she complained. And one day we were watching some of your video, and after watching some of your video, we were discussing at the end.
Yeah.
And she said, no, but you know, this looks interesting, and then, but for me it's difficult to apply this because I have my invoice to pay, I have a stressful job, I am here in London, just in a small room. So, if I live like a monk, it's maybe easy to apply, but I don't see how to apply this in my normal life, and I don't know what to answer.
The answer is so simple. Please ask me what I do every day. I run 4 or 5 monasteries. I call them my franchises. I've got to decide how we can raise enough money for Bhikkhuni Monastery and pay for looking after a nun. They're very cheap to look after. But sometimes there's not enough funds to look after them, you know, to get the fares and just to get the medicines. You need some iron tablets or something. Don't have money ourselves, and I have to look after that. I would look, if you actually ask any of the monks who live with me or any other people how much work I do, they can't believe just how much I do. So a monk is not, I wish it was like you thought, where you could just live in your cave and just, you know, really sit on your bum all the time. That would be lovely, that's my fantasy. But the real world is, I got to work like a dog. The There's many similarities. Dogs eat out of bowls, so do I. They live in little kennels, I live in caves. Dogs, they just take the master around for a walk and wag his tail, and that's what I have to do. Have my photograph taken and smile. So I just walk. That's my job. Out of kindness, that's what a dog teaches. Compassion and kindness. A dog never complains, neither do I, except now. So actually, you work very hard, and that's one of the reasons why I know what it feels like. I'm a CEM, Chief Executive Monk. So yeah, I've got a little tablet over there. I've been afraid to open up and find out what goes on. Yeah, sometimes monks go sick. Sometimes they go crazy. Sometimes the committee goes crazy. Sometimes things fall on the ground when you're trying to give a talk. And life is like that. There's so many things to organise and have to look after. It's only a small monastery, so I look after in Australia. The monks' monastery, what is it now? 390 acres to look after with 24 monks, and lots of people wanted to become monks. A huge community. I got my retreat centre, $5 million retreat centre, you always look after it, solve problems. We have a very small Bhikkhuni monastery, 583 acres to look after. And what else we have? All these other monasteries, building another joint monastery, Bhikkhunis and Bhikkhus, just south of Melbourne. And what else am I doing? Oh yeah, looking after a Cambodian Buddhist group, because they got into big debt, so I use my disciples to pay off their debt. And what else am I doing? Looking after the Brahm Centre in Singapore and the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, which I usually look after and teach at, and the Brahm Education Centre in Singapore. You can understand where that came from, Brahm Education Centre. Her brother, Meta Vihari. That's the Brahm Society in Colombo. That's what he calls it. That's her brother runs the Ajahn Brahm Society. So that's another franchise in Colombo, which her brother is running. What else do I do? Oh yeah, Egi Pasiko Foundation in, Indonesia. The BIF, I don't know why they call it BIF, that's Bodhidharma International Foundation over in Hong Kong. I'm the founding president of the Australia Sangha Association, trying to get all the Sangha different traditions all together to actually to do something. Just like with the problems in Myanmar. To have a joint statement, give it to the government, protect the temples, to say Buddhists are actually doing something. Not just sitting there sort of saying, oh, this shouldn't happen. Oh, we shouldn't do this. Oh, this is wrong or whatever. There are people who are homeless in Bangladesh right now. We don't have enough food. They're really struggling. And so the Buddhists, basically, yeah, that's another problem, how they got to be like that, who's responsible, but right now, they need food and shelter. So it's only a small amount, but I managed to raise $6,000 just before I left. They send over there, find out exactly where you send it, so you know it's going to get there for the people in need. That's also the things I do. So it's not really much. How to deal with it, yeah. So that's actually understanding how you deal with it. Quick story, it's in one of the books, pushing wheelbarrows for my master Ajahn Chah. After 6 days of hard work, they couldn't decide where they wanted this blooming earth. One said put it over there, put it over there, 3 days of really hard work. The other one said put it over there, so we moved it back again. You know what masters are like. The one master says one thing, one master says the other thing. I don't care, as long as you agree, because I'm the one who has to do the work. So, after 6 days, I lost my faith in Ajahn Chah and everyone else. I never became a monk to put wheelbarrows of earth all day in the jungle, being bitten by mosquitoes at one meal a day. Malnourished, abused, I wish I had a union. But we didn't. But one of the monks, they saw me. I was angry, I was upset, disappointed, frustrated, just being exploited. And he came up to me, he said something which I'm sharing with you now. He said, pushing a wheelbarrow is easy. thinking about it is the hard part. And that just changed the whole perception. Whatever you have to do in life, sir, no matter how much business it is, doing it is the easy part. Thinking about it is the difficult part. So that's what I learned how to do. Building mountain knowledge is easy when you don't think about it. It just happens. Giving a talk, easy. Don't think about it. Dying is easy when you don't think about it. So that's the trick. We worry so much, we think so much, we don't sleep, lose our energies, lose our positivity, we think too much, which destroys our effectiveness. Ta-da! Okay, ring the gong. Yes, there it goes. Excellent. So, hope you enjoyed that. Remember to do everything you've got. Ta-da! All the best, see you next time. Very good. All the best, bye bye. And I always say, don't do anything I wouldn't do.